So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
So the left, American left's hair is still on fire over the interview that Tucker Carlson got from Vladimir Putin. I don't know. I just thought he was being a journalist and interviewing a powerful world leader who was at war, which is what I thought we did. But another thing happened right around that time, which is President non compos mentis Joe Biden turned himself into a bowl of jelly on national television, screaming like an old man with waving a cane. It was very sad. Not sad. I mean, it was dangerous and afraid and frightening for our country. And all over the world, that moment, there were intelligence officers from China, France, in Brussels, Japan, Germany, name it, Iran. And they were studying everything that the president was saying and doing, coming back to their bosses, their heads of state, who are serious men, and trying to answer the question, how far gone is he and how can we take advantage of it? And there's nobody better to talk to on this subject than my brother, Nicholas Cass, for 30 plus years, a veteran of the U.S. State Department, the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Council, and other postings that put him in different and difficult spots, but always with an eye to helping our country. Nick, welcome to the Chicago Way.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Jeff. It's great to be here with you guys. Hello from balmy Romania, in an area outside of Bucharest.
Bear-free at this time of year?
Bear-free, snow-free.
But I mean, it Spetsnaz-free?
I'm sure it is, for at least in parts of the in this part, probably. I don't know about further downtown. But I'm sitting out in my yard. The grass is green. I have a Cuban cigar, and I'm drinking a fine Romanian single malt whiskey, and life is good.
You know? Beautiful.
Well, Nick, tell us what it would be. Tell us what goes through the mind of a intelligence officer when Joe Biden is playing the angry grandpa with the cane.
Well, I can tell you a couple of things. One, everybody in Europe, say, down to the level or up to the level of Uber driver, is very, very aware of this problem. Everybody knows. There's no pretending. There's no ability. There's no way to whitewash it or hide it. Everybody knows that the president of the United States is seriously compromised, not only mentally, but also legally. Had it not been for his very protective Justice Department, we could we'd be in even a more difficult immediate situation. But I think that it's clear that everybody understands that the guy who's running the show, or at least the person who was is nominally supposed to be running it, is not capable. And then that raises the question, who's running the show? You know, and it's funny, I think I sent you a picture earlier today of Jill Biden at a desk in Air Force One, talking about how she was prepping for the G7 or whatever it was.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Is it Jill Biden or
Jill? Jill, Dr. Jill.
Oh, you mean Edith Wilson, as she's called.
Edith Wilson, right. Called. Let me just look at the picture here, but it's kind of like she is sitting behind a desk and she's talking about prepping. It looks like it's in Air Force One, and she's talking about prepping for the G7 like she's the president of the United States of America.
Oh my God.
Because she is.
Well, yes, it's either her or maybe it's she was working with somebody from the outside. I mean, at this point, you can have a lot of fun with the theories. But it is interesting that in this respect, that the Heard report was kind of like, on the one hand, the fact that they said he was non compos mentis, but they wouldn't press charges because of that, shields him from immediate legal jeopardy, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also like, what, polonium 210, right? You put it in, and it's like basically going to destroy him politically, because mm-hmm. There's no hiding it now. And I think the big testament to that fact is the fact that so many of the mainstream media are piling on people who were part of the conspiracy of silence on this issue are now abandoning ship. And so the question is why and who benefits from that. And it's clearly not the Bidens. It was interesting. I also heard one of Obama's wingmen, Eric Holder, tweeting about how unconscionable Heard's statements were about Biden's mental acuity. But, you know, again, being the cynic that I am, I just wondered whether or not he was privately, clapping his hands as he wrote that, demonstrating that, of course, Obama world is fully on board and right. support of the president, but secretly
on paper.
Yes. And secretly very, very happy to see, see this happen. The question is there enough time to make a change or are they stuck? Now, Biden is nothing if not stubborn. And so we'll see, to what extent he's able to hang on to this. But I think it's that kind of situation we are now in, the worst possible situation for the president of the United States, which means at a time of war in the Middle East that seems to be metastasizing, at a time that the war in Ukraine has failed cataclysmically, where China is in the wings, you have other things to worry about. That this is not the time, if there ever is a time, for this kind of weakness in the Oval. And again, it's not the question of he's weak because he's not attacking Iran. He's unable to appreciate the maneuvers of his international rivals, nor is he able to appreciate the maneuvers of those people who are trying to unseat him. And the question is, who is that? And, we'll have to see how that shakes out.
So either he's unfit to stand trial, but he's fit to serve as president of the United States?
Well, I think the fair way to...
How do you solve that?
Well, you don't. I mean, yeah. So the fair way to look at this, I think, is whoever Heard is and what his motivations are, he clearly didn't want to try the president. It's kind of like Comey not wanting to try or to push the button on Hillary, even though he wanted to slam her.
But they push the button on Trump, don't they? Yeah, they push a lot of buttons.
So. And so what that means then is that this returns to the sort of political operation, the political realm, the legitimate political realm, which would be the impeachment route or the 25th Amendment. And I think the impeachment is probably more likely. As a matter of fact, I think if you're going to impeach President Trump on the grounds that upon which he was impeached with the, Ukraine and that whole operation that happened, impeachment is still available. And the issue is if you don't use impeachment here, then what do you use it for? And it's already been so discredited by what happened at the end of the Trump administration that it falls. It runs the risk of falling into perpetual disuse, and it's unfortunate because it's there for a reason, and it's kind of there for these kinds of reasons. And so we'll have to see what they do. I think somebody did file impeachment articles of impeachment already. Who knows whether those will go forward. I suppose the Republicans will want to just keep the issue alive as long as possible without actually getting rid of them.
Certainly they don't want Michelle Obama to come in and kick their ass.
Right. Right.
They want the weak guy to stay there.
Make it Kamala or whatever. Yeah.
But Nick, here's the thing. As a brilliant man wrote recently, and I quoted him in Sunday's column, one indication to watch, this was weeks ago, in an essay called The Deep State and the 2024 Presidential Election Down to the Crossroads.
Right.
This was published in the American Greatness. All right. The quote is, one indication to watch for could be whether elements of Biden's Department of Justice, which has so far worked hard to shield the president, begin to re-examine some of the corruption and other allegations of wrongdoing aimed at the president. Now, wait a minute. That's what's happening right now, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. Looks like it. And so, I mean, well, there's many more things that potentially could unfold here. And so we'll just have to watch it. But, I mean, if you were looking at this as a foreign country, you would be looking at this as a gentle way to try to ease him out without having to draw the sword.
Yeah.
Well, you don't want to draw the sword completely from its sheath, but you want people to look at it. It's like, you know, you go into a bar downtown somewhere and something happens and some guy pulls his coat back and he's showing his gun, right? He's not drawing the gun on you, but guess what? You just saw the gun. So you're going to maybe think twice about continuing to do whatever it was that you were doing. So, you know, I think that this is, I mean, the problem with that, and thanks for referring to that, John, but I think what the issue with that is that, you know, Biden was happy to ride the deep state tiger. We talked about this in the article, and actually was encouraging publicly and privately the Justice Department and others to go after Trump, right?
Right.
The thing is, once you conjure up those beasts, once you get the genie out of the bottle or unleash the Kraken or whatever you want to call it.
Once you break glass, right?
Once you break glass, there's no guarantee that you're going to be able to control it. And we may be seeing a situation where there are certainly people in the deep state who do not share President Biden's repeated assertions that he is fully capable of running this country. And so we'll have to see what happens. But I think it's a very, very troubling moment. You know, I mean, this is part and parcel of what we've done to ourselves over the course of the last, well, particularly the last 7 years, but even longer with respect to the way the administrative state really runs. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
Since 9/11.
And even before. I mean, I think it started back in, Eisenhower, the Republican, was talking about the military-industrial complex. And I remember the first time I heard that phrase, I thought it came from Chairman Mao. I mean, I had no idea that a World War II hero and president of the United States and a Republican to boot was the guy who came up with that phrase. So, so I think we're seeing that evolve into this apparatus now that seems to be operating without any regard to the political masters. And so we'll see how far that's gone. I mean, I don't think it's consolidated to the extent that it did in Turkey, where everything was operating according to, you know, the dictates of those who controlled it. So there are still places that, you know, in the bureaucracy where people, I think, want to continue to operate in a constitutional manner. I believe most people are thinking of that, but the trend is not good. And I think the other side of looking at this whole issue with Biden is you compare his performance and his weakness, intellectual and otherwise, to the performance we saw the other night with Tucker Carlson from Putin. And, you know, people don't like him. That's great. But I don't think there's any question after watching that, if you haven't watched anything like that before, that you know now that you are presented with a formidable man in charge of that country. And it's not a joke.
Not only could he drop missiles down your head, down your throat, but he could tear your head off with his own hands and do it, you know?
Well, yeah. And, you know, he's a legit judo black belt on it.
Yes.
Yes. True. His technique is excellent.
He's not just wrestling bears like in a photograph.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. But anyway, I think that's the flip side of this. And so, you know, he's the guy who is fully in charge. And what you saw there was very, very revealing. And I think you talked about this a little bit in the intro about, you know, my previous life you know, in intelligence. And, you know, I can only say that, and this is what I did when I heard the interview. I mean, I did what I imagine there are people all over the world doing, poring over that. with extraordinary detail and attention, listening to what Putin said and looking at the body language and everything else, mm-hmm. and learning a great deal. So the idea that this was a pointless interview or that nothing would come of it, I find that really odd for people in a democracy to argue. It might just be embarrassing to them.
Yeah, they just hate Tucker. That's all they want. They just hate him.
They hate Tucker. They feel threatened by him and Rigelis, perhaps, and also threatened by Putin because of the challenge that he is, direct challenge that he's posing to American hegemony. And that's true. I mean, that he is a challenge. And there's no question about that.
Nick and Jeff, I'll just tell you one thing. There's nothing like perpetually frightened, hysterical journalists of the left mm-hmm. who like scream and cry and pout and stamp their feet and bark like little dogs when they see something that frightens them. I've only been dealing with that for 35 years, Jeff.
Nick? Something like that.
Something like that, yes.
I mean, you see these hysterical people yeah. responding to people like this, and it just, I find it interesting. I know you've had your own share of hysterical former colleagues.
Nothing like that.
Nothing on that massive scale, but significant enough. But, you know, I think it was...
Well, you know what? I always say, Nick and Jeff, mm-hmm. I always say that they're welcome. If they want to talk like real tough guys, they're always welcome to do so directly. But yeah. I might bring them, if not a poppy seed coffee cake, maybe something more. You know. How's that?
Well, you know, it is amazing that so much of what you see now that stands for journalism in America is about posturing. And it was interesting. I was watching the Tucker interview, and he was able to get more out of Putin, I think, valuable information that people will be paying attention to, I guarantee you. Right. He was able to get more out of Putin by approaching the interview in the manner that he did than so many of these other ones. And I saw there was one on YouTube, an old interview from some dude at NBC who was talking to Putin. And it was all about, look at me, I'm asking Putin the tough question about whether he killed people or something like that. And I'm just like, okay, all of that, it's good that people know that, right? But what are you expecting to get out of the interview? Are you learning anything about Putin's motivation with respect to, the situation in Ukraine or the challenges with the United States or whether or not he's going to be better friends with Russia or China? Is he worried about that? What's he doing with Turkey? How's he trying to, or Türkiye? How's he trying to, forge a relationship there that creates more and more, or with Hungary, that creates more and more internal tension in a NATO that is so ideologically driven by the United States that it can't see straight. All of these things were not even on the table in these other interviews, but I'm sure he got a lot of attaboys, and that's what he was playing for. He's playing for an American audience that this other fellow and was not interested in eliciting any information. I mean, I thought, you know, Tucker letting him talk, I mean, put it this way, you guys have been in that in the business of journalism and in the business of cultivating sources and trying to figure out how to get people to realize that you're not going to screw them and that you're going to be able to, and that you want to hear what they have to say. I mean, there are times when you do that. And one of those things is to sort of let people talk.
Right. And, you don't whip the notepad out of your pocket and start asking them how to spell their names in the first 5 minutes.
Or you don't journalists say, are good listeners, and that's 100% true.
I mean, if you're a journalist, you don't say, hey, jerk, or something. You know, hey, now tell me everything I want to. You know, it just doesn't work that way. So back to Putin and Biden. Right.
From the intelligence officer's perspective,
right.
What happens in the seconds after the interview's done?
Well, I mean, put it I can just tell you what I do now. You know, right. I mean, I listen carefully. I may take notes. I may look at the certain questions and look at his reactions. How much eye contact was he making? How often did he turn away? Didn't look like he did much turning away, by the way. And understanding you know, what his perspective is on these things. Now, I think Putin made a very strong case about the problem with the whole NATO approach to expansion in the region, and particularly with respect to Ukraine. I mean, I think he made an unassailable argument in that respect. This is not, there is, as bad as people want to say Putin is, which is fine, let them say that. You know, he did invade Ukraine, you know, 8 years after the war started. But the fact of the matter is that there is a the United States contributed to that by its kind of adamant stance about how Ukraine was going to go into NATO. And you still hear Tony Blinken talking about that, and which is absolutely ludicrous. So you can see that there's like this, you know, just a strange dynamic between a Washington that can't see outside of the ideological box and a Putin who, of course, sees the world in a completely different way. Now, you may not like it, but that's the way he sees it. And so the question is, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to address it?
You are speaking to us from Romania.
Yes.
Now, what is the attitude of the people of Eastern Europe? Because in America, the war hawks like Lindsey Graham, who are, you know, are always constantly pushing for war and toughness and posturing. Are the people of Romania and Eastern Europe, are they afraid that Putin's tanks are going to roll right over them now? That that Ukraine, if Ukraine falls, which it is anyway, it's going.
Well, they're small countries and they're very, very vulnerable, and they remember very well what it was like to be under Soviet domination. So I think that that's a fear that they have. But on the other hand, they also, I would say, they also are worried that, and we've talked about this before, that, you know, the guys who are running the show in Washington haven't the foggiest clue and are actually making it worse. And so, I mean, if you look at the actual effect of this, you know, people signed on to what the Americans were saying, the smaller countries in particular, without any power to push back or interest in pushing back, and hoping that somehow by following, as one senior diplomat here told me, you know, checking our brains out to Washington, whether or not this would pay off. And instead, what they've seen is that, if anything, the Russian military has become more effective and much more powerful. And that, you know, we're on the verge of seeing Russia encroach even closer to the borders, like of Moldova or Romania, rather, and Bulgaria and other places. So, in other words, the American approach to this has actually made things worse. And it's obviously having its effect on NATO's internal cohesion. And, you know, again, we talked about this before the war even started, John. I think when we talked about you know, the Monty Python character, Mr. Creosote, mm-hmm. and getting that last wafer and exploding. I mean, I think we've done that to ourselves. We didn't have to play ball in this way. I mean, again, you know, we decided to turn this into the be-all and end-all. And so I think it's ironic and actually quite insulting for American politicians and bureaucrats and others to say things like, if we back down now, it's, you know, we're going to lose Ukraine.
It sounds like Nikki Haley talking.
It's the Nikki Haley and, frankly, the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, who ought to know better, and all these other people. Because, no, it's not about whether or not Congress provides another $60 billion to Ukraine at this stage in the game. If you really wanted to avoid this kind of strategic catastrophe, you shouldn't have got into it. It's like Odysseus. It's like Odysseus said to Agamemnon, in the Trojan War, when the Trojans were counterattacking, and Agamemnon was saying, oh, this is the disaster. Odysseus kind of grabbed him by the lapels and said, no, you're the disaster. And that's what the disaster is, our elites who led us into this problem. We would not have had this situation had they not behaved in this way. And some of them know better, and they went along with it, and to their eternal shame. And so now we're in the situation. So, Is our defeat here in Ukraine as bad as it is for the Ukrainians? No. There are some generals out there talking about how if we lose this war, you know, we're going to have lost as much as the Ukrainians. I would not say that. But is it a strategic debacle of epic proportions for the United States? Yes. Yes. And whose fault is that? The guys who made a step off the line with the policy that led to this 2 years ago and more.
The policy of all this belongs to Barack Obama and Joe Biden.
And George Bush.
Yeah. They're the ones who let's expand NATO. Let's push Russia all over the map. Let's get Raytheon happy. Let's create machines of war and make a lot of money in North Carolina and South Carolina. Yeah.
So the trick for the United States now, I think, is to try to shore up its relations with these NATO countries in the East, make wise policy that helps ensure their security, does that without war. Do these people really fear that the Russians are going to march across? I'm sure many of them do. But the fact of the matter is that this, as Putin himself said, one, this would be ludicrous. Even if he was lying, it's still ludicrous to think of that. Secondly, they don't have that capability. So what you are now being confronted with is a last-ditch effort by the same people who got us into this mess to try to shift blame to others and also raise the specter of this extraordinary conflagration in Western Europe as a means to save their own asses. And it's actually not only bad for the United States on a personal level, I think, for the American voters who are supposed to be the people who are ultimate decision makers through their representatives. It's insulting to their intelligence. It's insulting to the intelligence of the American people to say that you can't listen to Vladimir Putin. Why? Because some bureaucrat is going to know better than me or better than you or better than other people?
Right.
Is that how this is supposed to work? What are we? Well, that kind of thinking is the consequence of precisely the deep state, administrative state mentality, which looks at the people as simply aphids to be managed on a leaf. You know, they're the ants. We're the aphids. They pick us up and position us somewhere else on the leaf where they want us to chew. And not supposed to ask any questions. It's the most ridiculous thing. It's quite embarrassing and insulting. And I think, I can only hope that, we'll see some reckoning about this in the election.
The American way is to tear off the whole leaf and then chew it up and spit it in a red Solo cup and have somebody sing a great song about red Solo cups. But it's not it's not that.
No, I mean, I think it's just ridiculous. And so all this talk about, we're letting Putin propagandize and this and that and the other thing. I mean, it's just, it's, again, speaking as a professional, all right? That interview was extremely noteworthy and revealing about Putin's own psychology. He let it out there, okay? And I think now that the American people have a better sense. Now, if they want to supplement their understanding of Putin and Russia with the propaganda of all these other people who are saying there's trouble in River City and that we get the sky's falling, great. Let's listen to that as well. Let's hear it.
But how do you juxtapose what we saw?
Right.
How do you juxtapose the Putin singleness of purpose?
Right.
And the resolute seriousness with the old man barking at clouds in the White House
of
the United States.
You don't. There's no squaring that circle. And I think, again, he could be the rubber stamp for other people who are basically making the decision, the people in the team around him, whatever it is, right? But the point of this, the big point here, putting aside that for the moment, just looking again at the strategic challenge that we face, we would not have been in this bad of a situation. Yes, in the post-Cold War world, we'd had our moment of unipolar superiority already, which we squandered away with stupid policies in the Middle East that we're still paying for, right?
Yeah.
But we would not have fallen so precipitously in the last 2 years had we decided at the last, at the 11th hour that, oh, wait a minute, before we do this, maybe there's a way to avoid this crisis. But instead, you have people like in the military, and Lindsey Graham and others who think that this is a good way to, quote unquote, bleed the Russians and talk about killing Russians. Could you imagine if Putin had said something like that and publicly? This is great, we're going to kill Americans. What do you think we would do? I mean, this is, it's just very, very troubling.
The fact that the media use him as a useful tool when they need it. You know, they want to get some sort of color in their commentary.
Yeah, he's like their Emmanuel Gorst. Yeah. You know, he can have the 2 minutes of hate against Putin. And the fact is that with this interview, he kind of broke out of that a little bit. So now, again, this is not about loving Putin. He is the leader of the...
He's a murderer. Yeah.
You know what? As President Trump said to somebody, you think we're so innocent?
Yeah.
We can all, you know... You know, what did, Michael, what's her name? The actress, Annie Hall actress, who played Kay in the movie, The Godfather?
It was a son, Michael. It was an abortion.
No, yeah. it was the one where he said, who's being naive, Kay?
Oh, yeah. my favorite, I just saw the ridiculous, I mean, ridiculous movie. Passed off as real stuff, directed by Robert De Niro, called The Good Shepherd. I mean, if I had been in CIA, I would be embarrassed to even be part of that burlesque, because...
Dude, John, let me just tell you, I have never been not embarrassed by movies about the CIA. I mean, it's like, you know how can you watch movies about journalists?
No.
I don't think you can. Right. Because they're all stupid.
That's right.
Right. So, I mean, that's the way, you know, and I try even, you know, anyway, it's just, I'm starting to rant now, I think.
No.
I think the bottom line is.
But in that terrible movie.
Yeah.
Which was so full of lies. And I did research on the film, and, you know, historians who study spycraft and espionage, they talked about it in detail, and it was just, they were really good, but they tore that movie up. But the point is that in the movie, there was a Joe Pesci character.
Yeah, the outfit guy.
And that's the only part I liked, where he turns to the James Angleton character, Matt Damon, and says, the blacks got their music, Puerto Ricans got their salsa, we got our thing, what do you got? And the CIA man says, we've got the United States of America, and you're just passing through. Now, that may have been true many years ago, but I don't know if it's true now.
Well, I mean,
the culture changed.
When I think about that movie, and I think of Robert De Niro's performance, and I think of that other, I think of that other performance that he had in some movie about the Red Scare, where he was like, "Have you no shame?" Right?
Yeah.
A great artist, great actor, right? But an artist is supposed to be someone who deploys his skill in an effort to understand the world. And yet here this dude, the guy who made that movie and the other guy, Have You No Shame, right, talking about the Red Scare in the 50s, sitting silently by when there was a coup d'etat against the president of the United States back in 2016, an effort to stage a coup. So this idea, I mean, okay, if you're consistent, be consistent. You know, if you're upset about that, be upset. So that's why I have more
consistency, Nick. Come on.
Yeah. I mean, that's why it's interesting to hear, you know, people like Glenn Greenwald being dissed by the left, because, of course, they would prefer to read him out of the game by saying he's moved when he hasn't. He's basically the same guy, just saying this is, now it's the turn of the left to be
authoritarian.
Right. So, I mean, this is, it's, again, I'm, forgive me, I think I'm just sort of, you know, ranting a little bit here, but it's just, we are in a very fractured moment here. And,
indeed.
Yeah, and it's. I think we're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, Nick, I gotta ask you. The phrase "deep state tiger" is now my new favorite phrase. So I love that. But in that vein, I mean, the deep state, you know, air quotes, because it's amorphous. The they wouldn't, that idea that there's something afoot or they've turned on Biden, that wouldn't do that unless there was a plan, right? I mean, that there isn't the, like, well, we got rid of this guy and let's hope something's better. I mean, in my mind, they're like, well, we got to move him so we can get this to this and this person to this and this to there. I mean, are they that well organized that they can think like that? Or is it really just a, let's see if this works kind of thing?
I'm sure if you're the Democrat Party and the donors, you're thinking of it in those terms. We got to get rid of this guy. Right. Why is so much Democrat money, billionaire money going to Nikki Haley for the same, clearly for the same purpose? Now, again, the deep state in the United States is not as consolidated as it was in Turkey, but the fact, and in, there are other countries, let's say in Eastern Europe, where the joke is that there are many deep states, okay, that there are various elements within the bureaucracy which are operating in the same way, but at cross purposes because they represent certain people and interests and others. Those are real, sorry to say, people. Mm-hmm. We haven't consolidated ours, but that's why this last 7 or 8 years is so important, because we're seeing the consolidation of that. Certainly has helped consolidate the media's role in perpetuating establishment power against challengers. I mean, that is a pretty clear indication.
That's what the media does now, doesn't it?
Right,
They find dissidents. They're the hunters. They find dissidents. They stick if they dare stick their heads up and say something about the government. The media is the group that hounds them and
They're the pointy end of the spear, and sometimes they think of themselves as participants, right? And partners when they're just tools. You know, it just reminds me, I remember this picture of Ernest Hemingway from World War II sitting down with some general telling him about talking strategy. I'm just like, dude, really?
I remember that.
Well, yeah, really? I mean, I love Ernest Hemingway. He's a great writer, but, you know, come on, man. You know, really? You're going to tell, oh, it's a good thought. I hadn't thought of that.
Like George Will and Charles Krautheimer inviting young President Clinton to their house and then Obama over for lunch, and we'll talk to him about, let him know the lay of the land. I mean, are you joking?
Look, Aristotle tried that with Alexander when he was 13 years old, okay? At least he got him when he was young. The idea that you're going to, become the brain of some guy who's already
some 50-year-old man, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the arrogance about it is just so odd. And it's not like they have any particular expertise or knowledge about the world or society or any particular area that they can impart to people. I mean, this is ludicrous.
We've talked about this, John. I mean, that's one of the things, the hallmarks of, unfortunately, my lifetime has been the rise of the specialist, the expert, if you will, and the people they throw on the media and they say, this person's an expert. They've got all these awards from all these places that have really nice DEI programs. And hey, we should listen to them about what we should do with masking, or we should listen to them what we should do about foreign. And it's this weird, expert by decree instead of actually doing. Well, it happens, as we've talked about on this podcast for years, is that the whole system has been morphed into this idea that if it's not progressive, it's not good for people. It's not the way of the future. It's not the way people should even behave. And my whole life, I was taught that, that if you go backwards, you're a terrible person. And I think that's been ingrained in us. And now it's the same. Those people are running the deep state type idea, and they're even more lost than we were. I mean, I take the deep state in the 50s versus the deep state today, because I feel like at least there they had a goal. There was a, some sort of idea that they knew what was good and what was bad. But again,
wise men.
Right.
I mean, John Foster Dulles and all those people.
Right. But by comparison today, they seem like, really on the ball.
Yeah, I'd say that the deep state of today is staffed by midwits who are basically thinking about one thing and one thing only, which is the characteristic of deep states in their decadence, which is how do I help preserve the power structure
so that I can benefit.
Right. I mean, it's just you think about. I mean, just think of it this way: You know, I remember there was this famous interview with Condoleezza Rice going on to Fox News and saying, and I think the interviewer was saying something like, it's horrible when a country, you know, invades another country without, you know, against the law and illegally or whatever. And she's like, yes, how horrible. You know, what happened to Iraq? What happened to Kosovo, right? All these things are, they're real, folks, and they actually have an effect on other people's minds. And you, one may not like it or not, but that is the perception. And so, and that's the same that we're confronting in the Middle East, obviously, by the way. So I think we're in this kind of situation now where the whole apparatus is falling apart brick by brick. And the question is, how can people preserve their meal tickets while in this kind of environment? And so there's going to be a lot more viciousness and the kinds of things that you're seeing as the things come to the surface. I remember, John, you told me once when you were on when you were in the Merchant Marine, you were in Africa, and you guys had an open hold, as I understand and remember, an open hold cargo ship. You were bringing grain, I think, from Louisiana to Africa or something like that.
Yeah.
And you were in Nigeria, and as you guys were vacuuming up the grain, and the grain started going lower, you would see the furrows, you know, sort of furrows shooting across the bottom of the hold.
Right.
And then it became clear that what those, what was creating those furrows were the rats who had been living in there, you know?
It was so like, I think, it was like the cartoons, like Warner Brothers cartoons in the desert, like with the rabbits digging furiously fast.
Right, and then all the grain, and once you pulled out all the grain, you just saw the rats bouncing off the wall. So I think
there was an epic battle. Me and a bunch of guys from the Middle East with scoop shovels, and we were smacking them across the cargo holds because,
didn't anybody have a 22? Couldn't they just ping them?
Dude. It's like you want to bounce a bullet in there. There's like,
oh, that's a good point.
That's why I say
a pellet gun.
Yeah, no way.
Soft press. All right. Well, we've taken a lot of your time, Nick. But before we go, I do have to ask you. I need a Casso brother story. I mean, you got to give me something. I'm looking for something in the realm of maybe like a high school going out for sports story, or if you got a John dancing to, you know, some music back in the day, something embarrassing.
I danced the way I do now with my white man overbite, and I don't even move.
Well, I remember, you know, I just think about, you know, the stuff you sometimes face, you know, on a daily basis. And I remember when you were a kid, there was this, we had a convict in the neighborhood. I remember this. Wow. Hmm. We had a convict in the neighborhood, and they were
just
like,
got out of prison for raping a woman.
Just got out of prison, and his brothers were on their way to prison. And there was a whole bunch of other people who, for whatever reason, decided that they wanted to kick your ass.
Right.
And I remember they like ganged up on you in the church parking lot. There's about 10 guys.
Yeah.
That was crazy. And then I remember seeing my dad ride up on a bike. I thought, oh, this is over. You know, my
dad on the Stingray. Right.
Stingray. And I'm like, wow, this is my dad. Yeah. And instead of saying, get the hell out of here, he made them all line up and made John fight them all one at a time.
What?
It was amazing. I'd never seen anything like it.
What? First of all, wait. How many guys was this, roughly? It was
probably about 10 guys. Yeah. And we're talking about guys who were, like I said, were on their way to prison. That was their higher education, okay?
Yeah, right.
And I remember you had to slug it out with every one of those guys.
Yeah.
And I had never seen anything like it. So by the time I got to where I was in the martial arts world, the karate world, and I was going on a I had to do a big fight about like against 40 people, right?
Yeah.
Same one at a time.
40 man kumite.
Yeah. 40 man kumite. But I remember
against black belts, not just.
God, we did that.
But you know what? But you know what? What you had to go through was way tougher because that was real. That was not like under controlled circumstance. I mean, people can punch you full contact in a dojo, and it's still a dojo. It's not like you're going to go on the ground and someone's going to start slamming your head on the ground, right?
Yeah.
So that was very, very instructive. And I think it also tells you a little bit about John. because that's the kind of character he was, you know. And I think it was a surprise to you, but I think that actually, if people are wondering why John's, you know, tough the way he is,
pugnacious.
You know, there was we had some pugnacious. That's the way. And we had some. There was some interesting times growing up in the South Side regions.
And, so, anyway. there are a lot of trolls who pour over all this stuff and try to find weapons and go on Twitter. They're pathetic creatures, really. But
I mean, it's really amazing. Like they think that's gonna be.
He didn't grow up in Chicago. He grew up in Oak Lawn. You know, like,
I mean, I just find it interesting. I mean, there are so many people who pretend to talk tough.
Oh, God, right. Especially on the internet. That's what the internet was invented for.
Who have no idea. And, they have no idea.
Absolutely.
And it would probably be good, I think, for many people to experience, what it's like to be put in that kind of a situation, because I think it changes your approach in a variety of different ways.
I've got one thing to say to Nick and Jeff in closing. This week, the other day, there was a great hero of our youth who died, Carl Weathers.
Ah, yeah.
Also known as Apollo Creed.
Yeah, he was great actor.
As part of the whole white man revenge against Muhammad Ali.
Right.
Drama, whatever it was.
Right.
So pathetic.
But in those days, of course, you could say, this is ridiculous. How could a small white guy beat a guy like Apollo Creed? And that was true. But if you look at boxing today, I mean, the baddest guy out there is Tyson Fury, even though he got smacked by Ngannou and got knocked down.
Yeah.
I mean, an MMA guy who doesn't know what he's doing basically almost knocked him out. But the fact of the matter is, you got some, there are great fighters out there, I think, of all different colors. But I never saw anything like what I saw you go through. That was something.
Oh, I'm going to start crying. Thanks, Nick.
Especially your dad doing it.
Dad, I couldn't.
He was right, though. He was right.
And why were they mad at you, John? Or why were they coming after you exactly? Or not exactly, but broad strokes? I mean,
I think because... I was a big mouth.
Okay.
And I deserved to get smacked. I did. And that's why I'm glad I went into football. Changed. I went into football where you'd get smacked around, you open your mouth and get smacked. And, I knocked around and had a few fights, but no guns or anything.
Sure, yeah.
Why were they upset? I think two guys came out and tried to beat my brother up. I think it was Nick or Pete. Two of their brothers on their way to Cook County Jail, and I smack them around, and then the older brother got out of Stateville, who had just raped a woman from in the back of the Agonai, maybe?
Yeah,
Agonai Tavern.
Yeah.
And
good place.
Nice
quarter family. Quarter for a beer.
Short beers. And he got out of it he raped her, used a hunting knife to rape her. And he came out looking for me.
Why you though? I mean, you weren't writing stuff at the
because
time,
I right? writing.
I mean, this isn't like you weren't like out blasting this guy. You didn't put him in jail.
His two brothers attacked my little brother.
Okay. Just because
I don't know, Nick, was it you or was it Peter?
I think it was, I can't remember. Yeah. I don't think it was me, but it may have been Peter. But maybe there was, I know there was one guy. Who, like So, I mean, you used to do that stuff. Used to.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I got.
But it was serious. That was serious, crazy stuff. And like I say, I went on to many years in Kyokushin martial arts, which for all the listeners out there, they know what I'm talking about. And, man, it still mystifies me.
Hajime, let's go.
Us. Anyway, so that's well, that's the story for today.
I love it. Well, Nick, you demystified it to an extent, the world at large. So I thank you for that. Speaking of demystifying, always good to have you. I got to tell you, I mean, I love just you, fall in listening to you and
thanks, guys.
Just taking it in. You do a great job of adding like an alternative perspective that people aren't getting in their everyday lives, which is great because
thank you.
As
thank
we've
you
talked so about, they're not getting it.
Thanks. And, you know, I, if, you know, I can be found at LinkedIn and in, at Twitter.
Yep.
So if people want to look up my name and see what I'm doing on Twitter, that's great too. Cause, you know, try to bring in a lot of different stuff about, other parts of the world as well that I know something about. So in any event, yeah, thanks guys. Always great to be on your show, John, Jeff. Thank you.
Thanks Nick.
For Nicholas Cass, 30 years. Plus, in service to the United States with the Department of State and with Central Intelligence Agency. Notice I didn't say the.
More importantly, 50 years plus as your brother.
And 50 years plus as my younger brother, who never, you know, once I love him, but he never wanted to cut the grass. Pete and I had to cut the grass. He was always saying, I'm too allergic. And then he'd go off to read about the exploits of Alexander or Eastern Roman history or something like that. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, friend of Kat's, future physics teacher, husband to Christine, and for me, John Cass, editor-in-chief of JohnCassNews.com, where you always get a good cup of common sense. Join us again next time, won't you, on the Chicago Way on WGN+.